Ryan Hardman, registration number 37922 for Cecil Herb. May it please the court. Cell phone location information is not immune from search. The police must simply get a warrant before accessing this information. Here, the police did not get a warrant, and no exception applies. So this court should suppress all of the evidence that was discovered on the evening of Mr. Herb's arrest, which was all fruit of the illegal search of Mr. Herb's phone.
Ms. Hardman, just refresh our memory. What specific evidence are we talking about that is, we can call the fruits of this search?
In the car, they found the gun, a clip, shells, maps to his friend's house in Wisconsin, and his journal, which had notes in it and evidence that the prosecution used to argue that he planned.
And was that journal then introduced into evidence?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, while you've stopped, Ms. Hardman, let me ask you, kind of getting right to the heart of the cell phone issue. Let's assume for a minute that we agree with you that there's a privacy interest. Tell me why we don't have exigent circumstances in this case, and we have a man kind of who's accused of, you know, killing somebody, you know, running off with an accomplice, arguably. Obviously, the police were concerned enough to have, what was it, 10 police cars there to stop him. Why don't we have exigent circumstances here?
There are two reasons that there are no exigent circumstances. Exigent circumstances requires first that the police have probable cause, and second, that they have an exigent circumstance. There was no probable cause, and...
Excuse me, probable cause for what? A search or to arrest the defendant?
Both. There was no probable cause to search the phone or the car or to believe that Mr. Herb committed this offense at the time of the cell phone ping. exigent circumstances allows for three different types of exigent circumstances. The first is hot pursuit. Here there was no pursuit. There was no chase.
Does it have to be a hot pursuit if we're not talking about following into a home? I mean, here we're talking about pursuing someone to apprehend them, but it's all in a location that's the public highway.
But there's no pursuit. They're not chasing him. They're looking for him, but they are not chasing him within the meaning of hot pursuit.
Well, how come it has to be a hot pursuit? That's what I'm asking. Because I know hot pursuit is required to go into an area of privacy, which is a home, but I'm not sure that that same immediacy is required just to pursue a felon.
That wouldn't fall under the exigent circumstances exception.
Well, there are some older cases that just talk about bona fide pursuit instead of hot pursuit.
The bona fide pursuit, except for part of this, requires that the police be pursuing the suspect away from the crime, and that's why it's exigent or immediate, that there's an immediate need that they apprehend him and prevent him from escaping. Here, Mr. Herb had already fled 36 hours before the search and the searches and arrest in this case.
Well, what about the destruction of the possible destruction of evidence?
So that's the second possible exigent circumstance, and that's the immediate destruction of evidence. In our Supreme Court case that came out yesterday, the Supreme Court said that the police must have a reasonable belief that the evidence is about to be destroyed. And here, 36 hours after the homicide, there's no reasonable belief that it's about to be destroyed. Right after the shooting, there would perhaps be a reasonable belief that the suspect could throw away the weapon or destroy evidence. But there's no reason to believe that 36 hours after the shooting, if the suspect hadn't already disposed of the evidence, that he would immediately dispose of it at that time.
I want to take you back just a step to the basic privacy right. And
yes.
I would like to ask if there are any guidelines or legal principles for determining when society recognizes an expectation of privacy. How do we know when that is?
It's an expectation of privacy that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable. It's an objective test. And I think under this circumstance, we all carry cell phones, and it's reasonable that we have an expectation, especially under Colorado law, that our cell phones not contain government surveillance devices, and under SPOR letter, that information that we have to disclose to our phone company just by virtue of possessing a cell phone or a phone, we don't lose our expectation of privacy.
Well, aren't there some differences between this case and SPOR later in that the devices that were in question in SPOR later were getting transmissions from a home or office because this was before the days of cell phones? So that's one difference. A home or office has traditionally been given a greater expectation of privacy than just out and about in the world. And also the information that was obtained were more content-based than this information, which was purely location. So aren't those important differences between this situation and SPOR later?
The same reasoning of SPOR later applies. The Supreme Court in that case found that the necessary disclosure did not alternate the expectation of privacy or transpose it into an assumed risk of disclosure to the government, and that the information disclosed, the phone numbers that the woman dialed in that case, allowed the police to construct a virtual mosaic of her life. And here the same reasoning applies, because in allowing the police to track Mr. Erb anywhere he goes, the police would be able to construct a virtual mosaic of his life. And also with the cell phone, you can't know before the police can't know before they ping the phone whether he will be in his home or on a road or in some other private area, at his doctor or at church.
Let me ask you this question. Does the planned use that the police have for the cell phone make any difference in the analysis? For example, a cell phone could be used to develop a crime. Let's say you've got someone who's suspected of being a drug dealer, so you use the cell phone ping to follow him around from drug deal to drug deal, but you don't really have a crime that's necessarily been committed. Or you can have a situation where there has been a crime and the police are simply using the information to locate and apprehend the suspect. Is there a difference in those two situations as far as society's expectation for privacy?
I don't think so. We all have an expectation of privacy in our cell phone location. Just by now, it's the person who doesn't possess a cell phone who is the exception.
Well, a person can turn a cell phone off, certainly, and then it's not subject to the pinging, as I understand it.
In this case, that was the testimony, that if he had turned it off, but he had no expectation that the police would be pinging his phone. Detective Kenny testified that they have to affirmatively activate some tool within the phone, the type of phone that Mr. Erb had, to begin pinging him.
So if a person is more technologically knowledgeable, do they have less Fourth Amendment protections than someone who doesn't understand how the cell phone works?
No, we all have the same expectation of privacy that our cell phones will not be converted into government surveillance devices against us.
Is the issue here that there was just no limit on where they were tracking Mr. Erb? In other words, they can go into his house, the mosaic that you talked about. We would know if he's in his home. We would know if he's at his bank. We would know if he was at a psychiatrist. Is that, does it make a difference that there was no limit like that? In other words, if we knew he was only driving on I-25, it's okay?
I don't think it is okay, even under the open roads doctrine. In Colorado, Oates rejects the open roads doctrine of Knotts. But even under federal law, after Knotts, you had Caro, where the police used the beeper to track the substance into a private home, and the Supreme Court found that was a Fourth Amendment violation. And then you have Kylo, where the police used technology unavailable to the general public to observe activity within a home. And
aren't most of the federal cases, though, of that line based on a trespass theory instead of just the simple CATS, reasonable expectation of privacy?
I believe Caro and Kylo are based on Kat's expectation of privacy. The new Jones GPS tracking case is based on a trespass theory. But in Jones, the concurrences are very interesting. They apply the Kat's expectation of privacy test and find that even short-term tracking is problematic. They find they echo, it's interesting, all of the concerns that our Supreme Court set forth in Sporletter and Oates.
I see your time's running a little bit short. I just want to ask you one last question. Could you explain why the evidence in this case, aside from the fruits of the initial stop, was not considered overwhelming?
Aside from the evidence obtained the night of his arrest, they had testimony from snitches and co-defendants, which all had, jailhouse informants and co-defendants, who all had a motive to testify against Mr. Erb. And it was just contradictory testimony to his own testimony that he acted in self-defense. And that evidence is not overwhelming.
Can I ask one more question, Ms. Hardman? I will let you reserve your time. Coming back to the cell phone, the pinging, and the exigent circumstance, you talked about the destruction of evidence. It was 36 hours later. We know this suspect is on the loose. If they decided to ping his phone in the first 12 hours, the first 8 hours, does that get you a destruction of evidence? I'm trying to figure out where the line is that you're drawing. It seems to me we have a murder suspect on the loose. Isn't there some urgency in finding him?
They should do investigation and try to locate him, and they should not violate his Fourth Amendment rights. I think, first, you're still assuming they have probable cause, which they don't. And then it has to be a concern for the immediate destruction of evidence, which I think would happen, they would have much closer in time to the offense. The typical cases in destruction of evidence cases are drug cases where the drugs can be flushed. Here, I suppose he could throw out the gun, but if he hadn't thrown it out within 36 hours, there's no concern that it would be about to be destroyed.
But they don't know if he did or not. They don't know where he is, and what they have is a murder suspect on the loose. Doesn't that give the police some urgency and an exigency in trying to find him?
They had 36 hours to get a search warrant, and Detective Kinney never tried.
But they also had information, and I know I'm impinging on your time here, that he was at least potentially a suspect in a burglary in Nebraska. So they got this guy on the road with a weapon, suspect in a homicide, possible suspect in later crimes. Why isn't this a colorable claim of an emergency threatening the life or safety of other people, which is the third exigent circumstance?
The third exigent circumstance is when he has a victim potentially with him, or that there's an emergency to the with the police's safety. And here in the Nebraska burglary, there was a different colored car. There was a woman with that person. There was never a woman with Mr. Erb. And there was no information about the weapon, just that there was a person of his size and stature. Mr. Erb is like a 5'8", 160-pound man. He's very average. And so the Nebraska circumstance should not factor into that. I'd like to reserve the remaining of my time, please.
Thank you. Very well. Thank you, Ms. Hardman. Mr. Michaels? It's on the right under the table, I think.
There we are.
That's a test, Mr. Michaels.
I think I passed. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. There are a lot of issues in this case, and I'd like to focus on about four of them, but with the understanding that anything that you want to bring up is fair game. There are four reasons that evidence was not required to be suppressed in this case. The first is the defendant simply had no reasonable expectation of privacy in his phone. and certainly in the location information of his phone. The second, as this court spent a lot of time talking about with opposing counsel, is that there were numerous exigent circumstance exceptions that applied to the location tracking information. The third one is that there are numerous exceptions, even if exigent circumstances didn't apply, that would have allowed the evidence to be admitted, including the one that the trial court found, which was the inevitable discovery. And the fourth one is that there was an objectively reasonable facts that merited him being pulled over by the Iowa officers at the time. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that fourth prong, but it is very relevant as sort of a fourth aspect of this.
Could now, we go back to inevitable discovery, since that's something we didn't touch on
sure.
with Ms. Hartman?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't, in order to decide that, well, even if this was a search, they would have inevitably discovered this evidence, wouldn't we have to conclude that the evidence would have been inevitably discovered before he made it to his buddy's house in Wisconsin and was able to potentially get rid of the weapon, and that he would not have been housed in Dubuque, Iowa with these two informants whose testimony was so damaging at trial?
A couple of responses to that. First, what we're talking about with the Wisconsin, him getting to Wisconsin and potentially destroying the evidence, that's all speculation. It's hard to quantify or even qualify how much of that would factor in because it's just all speculative. So the idea with the evidence might have been destroyed or he might have gotten rid of the journal or the gun by the time he got to Wisconsin is beyond the scope of the inevitable discovery analysis. The inevitable discovery analysis looks at what were the officers doing in order to track him down at the time, and we have all the information in the suppression hearing. He talked to his ultimate co-defendant, the victim's ex-wife, and they ultimately, the day after he was arrested, talked with who would have been his accomplice, Mr. Bruner, who basically told them everything, what they were planning to do. So they had all that information, including the fact that he essentially planned to escape to Wisconsin. Whether or not they would have retrieved the weapon in Wisconsin, it's hard to say, but you can't omit that based on pure speculation of whether or not he might have destroyed it by the time he first got to Wisconsin.
As I recall, defense counsel cited Diaz for the proposition that they have to have already undertaken some efforts to get the search warrant, and they had not. Would you agree that at the time they got the ping, they had not yet begun trying to get a search warrant for the car?
They had not started looking for a search warrant. They had started applying for an arrest warrant for Irv himself because they believed they had probable cause for him. And again, I know I mentioned this in my brief, but I disagree with the trial court's order. I think the trial court was trying to be very judicious about how it found probable cause. And the trial court specifically said, I found probable cause that Herb was involved in the murder and that the car that left was involved. So they had probable cause for the car to be searched. And that's in the orders that I attached in the appendix. I can't remember the exact paragraph number. I certainly can look very carefully, but it's certainly in the orders that I attached as an appendix. Regarding the...
Mr. Maggis, let me interrupt before you move on, because I would like you to address this probable cause issue, because it caused me a little bit of concern. We've
sure.
got findings. We talk about exigent circumstances. I think you both agree you've got to have probable cause before we get to exigent circumstances. We have a finding from the trial court. There was no probable cause. And so that gives me a little bit of heartburn as to how we could get there. So could you help me? I understand you just said you think there was probable cause. Tell me how we overcome the factual finding by the trial court.
Certainly. Well, and as I understand it, that would be a legal finding that there was no probable cause. And as the trial court laid out the facts, you can track what the trial court is reading, which is talk to the victim's ex-wife. The victim's ex-wife said, or had a gun. He may or may not have sold it, but at least a couple days beforehand, he was asking people to buy bullets for that gun. The bullets found at the crime scene were bullets that were consistent with the type of gun that the ex-wife identified. They go through this whole list of what they knew, of what she knew, what the trial court knew, excuse me. And the trial court ultimately said, I don't know that he necessarily was the one who pulled the trigger. It could have been him, it could have been Mr. Brunner, because at that time they were looking for the two suspects. They had the information that they had been staking out the victim's house. They had all this information. And as a legal matter, the trial court concluded that I don't know that I can say Mr. Irv with certainty or had probable cause that he did the murder, but I found that he was involved in the commission of the murder, and I found that this car was involved in the commission of the murder. To that extent, the finding that Irv didn't commit the murder, first of all, it's wrong based on the facts that the trial court laid out, and this court reviews that determination de novo anyway. But second of all, it slices the cheese a little too thinly, because basically the trial court found there was probable cause that they, Bruner and Irv, committed the murder. I, the trial court, just don't know which one pulled the trigger. And that's where the probable cause determination is different than in terms of Mr. Irv might not have been the murderer, it might have been Mr. Bruner. But either way, there's probable cause that they were involved.
So if just for argument's sake, if we were to disagree with you and say there was a privacy interest in the cell phone and his location, do we need to make that finding of probable cause and basically agree with you and then say why there are exigent circumstances? Do we have to do that analysis?
I don't think you have to. I think it certainly helps, but I think under the facts of this case, you have fleeing murder suspects, and they certainly identified two suspects. They identified, as Judge Boda, I believe you pointed out, that this was an ongoing criminal escape. They fled the murder scene. The car immediately left the state. The police picked up as soon as they could. They didn't necessarily have a car that could chase a police patrol car that could chase the suspect car out of the state, but they immediately started investigating. They talked to the victim's ex-wife. They talked to the victim's son. They found out as much information as they quickly could, and instead of throwing the sirens and going after them, they put together information and said, this guy has left the state. He's fleeing. We have the spouse, Ms. Watson, affirmatively lied to them, saying, I think he went to California, when in fact they find out that he's going to Iowa or to Wisconsin ultimately. They have a sighting in Nebraska. It may or may not be him. We don't know, but certainly the information is consistent. It was apparently in his hometown, or at least a town that he lived in childhood, that's just off I-80 on the way to Iowa. He's seen in Des Moines, which is still on I-80 on the way to Wisconsin, and he's arrested ultimately on the only road, frankly, that goes through northeast Iowa to Wisconsin.
Mr. Michaels, I hate to interrupt you while you're on a spin about the probable cause, but I'd like to quickly ask you about the statute enacted in 2014, 16.3.303.5. Isn't that statute, the enactment, so I mean, I understand that was after the crime, so the statute itself is not applicable, mm-hmm. but isn't the enactment some indication that there's a expectation of privacy that society finds reasonable in the location of a cell phone?
I think as a broad rule, yes. But I don't think in this circumstance, and the statute explicitly draws an exception saying that when exigent circumstances apply, I believe it's subsection D, says that when exigent circumstances apply, that goes out the window, you don't need a warrant. And what we have here, again, is we have that fleeing murder suspect. We have, he's armed, he's committing crimes on his way out the door. And we talked about the hot pursuit of a fleeing suspect. I think this is very, it is different because we're not talking about breaking into somebody's house to get after the suspect. We're talking about somebody who's hit the road, they know he's on the road, they have independent confirmation of that at least two potential points along the way. You also have the risk of immediate destruction of evidence. I think probably that's the weakest of the three prongs under the exigent circumstances, and I think probably the strongest is the colorable claim of emergency threatening the lives of others. You have a home invasion burglary, you have a desperate murderer with a extensive violent criminal history on the run who's just spent time modifying his assault rifle so it can have a higher capacity of rounds. You have all the check marks. You have the grave offense. You have the belief that he's armed. You have the probable cause that a crime was committed. You have the likelihood that the defendant will escape. He's in the process of escaping. And you have the belief that the suspect is on the premise. You have him tied to that cell phone. So you have everything that an exigent circumstance would require, both under the statute and under traditional exigent circumstance law. And exigent circumstances, as this court knows, has to be a flexible determination. I want to mention something. Opposing counsel mentioned yesterday's Supreme Court case, the People versus Ackerman, and it talked about what's an exigent, what's the likelihood of destruction of evidence. Well, that was in a blood draw for a DUI resulting in death, essentially. But there was an interesting quote from that I think is very applicable here, and that's the officer testified, we did everything we could to get a warrant in a timely manner, but we were unable to do it in such a timely fashion that, in this case, would have prevented the destruction of evidence. The same rationale applies here. The court or the police officers, as quickly as they could, researched, investigated this case, and tried to get a warrant. They were in the process of applying for an arrest warrant at the time. And so I think to the extent that Ackerman even applies, it only reaffirms that the police officers were acting properly in pursuing a warrant, in pursuing their investigative leads, but also trying to protect the public. Judge, about returning to a question that you had maybe in the first minute of my argument, you'd also asked about the jailhouse informants. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but they were never challenged below, so they're inappropriate to be considered for suppression here anyway. Based on longstanding law, if it's not challenged below, then the suppression isn't valid. The suppression argument isn't to be considered on appeal. But in any event, they might have been discovered, or it might have been different jailhouse informants. So it goes back to that speculation argument, I think.
Well, I went on a tangent, Mr. Michaels. Let me ask you about these two witnesses who testified that they were afraid of Mr. Erb.
Okay.
I recognize that's kind of the last of many arguments, but that was troubling to me. I'm having trouble understanding what was the possible relevance of someone saying, I'm afraid of this man, other than a victim. I get that, but...
Sure. Well, Bruner was one of, would have been the co-defendant, or would have been a co-defendant in this case, except for the fact that he thought, you know, I don't want anything to do with this. And so I want to be out of this. And he basically, in the context of the case, he hid for a week in order to essentially let Herb go through with the killing without finding him and corralling him to doing it. So that was directly within the context of Brunner's participation. It wasn't an intentionally illicit comment, and certainly in the volumes of evidence against him, it's not going to be considered as anything besides this is a dangerous plan and he wanted no part of it. The same thing with the other witness. Apparently, Herb had tried to talk to her about killing this victim a year in advance, and she had the same principle, the same reaction, which is, I don't want to do anything, but I'm scared to say no because the situation, the facts, the circumstances are all, it's a tension-filled instance, and I think that's all that you can take out of it. And again, against the volume of evidence, even if it was error, it was harmless.
Wait, didn't she agree with defense counsel on cross-examination that, yeah, this guy was just a blowhard and nobody believes anything he said, and no, I didn't really think he'd do it?
It's certainly possible, and if that's the case, it would go completely counter to what to her statement that he's a fearsome guy, and it also would have suggested the defense counsel open the door.
Well, okay, but I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but can you open the door then to allowing a jury question follow-up? Were you afraid he was going to kill you? It seems to me that jury question is pretty relevant to the whole thing that was brought out on cross-examination about her alleged view that he wasn't serious.
I do think that would be in response to that question on cross-examination. I do think it would open the door. And we have case law saying that statements and made an opening can open the door to subsequent potentially inadmissible things. And again, I just think it's harmless under the volume of evidence that he was facing. I do want to talk very briefly about Jones and Riley, and then the most recent case, Grady, because Riley came up several months after I filed my answer brief, and I never even talked about it in my answer brief for essentially that reason. But Riley very much focuses on the search incident to arrest aspect of invading a defendant's phone to go through stacks of content-driven information. It's a proactive move by the police to invade a defendant's space. And this just doesn't apply here because it's content driven and there's an affirmative action by the police. With Jones, you have that same, again, it's on the trespass, and same thing with Grady. I'll put Jones and Grady together because they're very similar in their analysis. You have the government proactively putting a GPS tracker on a car in Jones and a parolee in Grady. And it's an invasion of their person or their property, and it's something that they can't take off or they're not aware of in the case of Jones. Here, it's, and I cited in my answer brief, it defies belief at this point in time that somebody doesn't understand that their phone can't be tracked, especially a fleeing murder suspect wouldn't believe that, hey, I should turn my phone off, I should take out the SIM card. If the police had done something to reach out and turn on the phone while it's turned off, maybe we'd have a different analysis, but we don't even have a GPS location. What we have is passive reception of cell phone signal bouncing off local towers. And we don't.
Mr. Mack, I'm going to give you an extra minute, so finish what you want to say. I'll give Ms. Hardman an extra minute as well.
Certainly. What we look at is we look at the reasonable expectation. Did the defendant manifest some attempt to exercise that reasonable expectation of privacy, and is it one that society is willing to honor? We don't have the defendant here never manifested an intent or an expectation of privacy. He didn't turn off his phone, he didn't remove his SIM card. And I don't think society is frankly willing to say, oh no, we don't understand that cell phones can't be tracked, and we certainly don't think the police officers shouldn't track for minimal real-time location information, find a fleeing murder suspect. And with that, I'd ask that you affirm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Michaels.
Thank you.
I ask the bailiff to add another minute to Ms. Hardman's time. Mr. Hardman, you now have 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Thank you. If the exigent circumstances exception applies in this case, it would apply in any case where the police have a missing suspect who they are looking for. If this court applies the exigent circumstances exception, you are broadening the rule beyond what the rule requires. There was no pursuit. There was no reasonable belief that the evidence was about to be destroyed 36 hours after the murder. And there was no ongoing emergency. Even if this court credits the testimony about the Nebraska incident, there was no ongoing emergency. The police were simply looking for a suspect who was missing. And there was no probable cause.
Do you know of a case that applies the exigent circumstance in a context outside entering a home?
There is a cell phone location information case where it may be Earls from New Jersey, where they find the expectation of privacy in the phone. But there was evidence that the suspect had the victim with him in the car while they were traveling. And because they had that concern about her safety, the court found exigent circumstances in that case. I want to quickly talk about the inevitable discovery doctrine, which we never got around to. The court in this case did not explain how the same evidence would have been discovered through lawful means that the police were pursuing at the time the illegal search occurred. Detective Kenny testified he made no attempt to get a search warrant for this evidence for the phone, even though he had done so and knew how to do so from other cases. The ping directly resulted in the seizure of this evidence. And a conclusion that the police may have found it later is pure speculation. Mr. Erb respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court's suppression order and remand the case for a new trial, and reverse his conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hardman, and thank you, Mr. Michaels. The court would like to thank you both for your excellent arguments. They are very helpful to the court. I know there are a lot of difficult issues in this case. We much appreciate it. And I'll say also, we appreciate your both actually reading the Supreme Court case from yesterday and being able to address it, which we also appreciate. That case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. You're excused with the thanks of the court.